Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Welcome to On the Continent, your one-stop podcast for all things European football. I'm Dotton Adebayo.
I'm Andy Brassel.
And I'm Lars Watson.
On today's edition, is the Bundesliga title race over at this halfway point, or is the thrill of a challenge still on the cards? And on the waterfront of Marseille, Andre Villas-Boas offers to jump ship as the walls of this Mediterranean Jericho crumble around him. And the transfer window brings to an end a fairy tale with possibly the deal of January. But first, let's talk about something that you've heard about, Andy, on the grapevine. Dele Alli, PSG, what's going on?
That's right. Le Parisien this morning says that Dele and PSG have come to an agreement on him making a move there. Obviously, Paris and Tottenham still have to come to an agreement, and you might say Daniel Levy's the tricky bit, as he often is in these kind of deals. But it shows that it's on the right road. It doesn't feel like a planned long-term signing necessarily. I think there's a sense of, try before you buy in it. And I think there's a sense of it's just one of those January opportunities that needs to be taken. It's an opportunity that needs to be taken by Dele because he's banging his head against a brick wall to get a bit against Spurs. From the Tottenham perspective, when they were batting off inquiries from Real Madrid a couple of years ago, he's nowhere near at that value, so they need him to be in a place where he can reinflate that value. And for Paris Saint-Germain, he's not only a player that Pochettino knows well, but a player, Lars, that could fill a number of different gaps for them.
Yeah, I think so. I think if you look at the PSG squad, you obviously have the sort of the fearsome duo of Mbappe and Neymar, and whether it's Icardi or Moise Kean who plays up with them, or if Di Maria's in there, whatever. But if you look at the midfield, it's all a little bit pedestrian. You know, you see Idrissa Gana Gueye, who's a great ball winner, but maybe doesn't move the ball so well. Ander Herrera, much of the same. You know, Paredes is in there. Danilo Pereira's there as well. So they have a lot of guys. I mean, weirdly, for a team that used to be very short on water carriers, they now have too many of them. And what can sometimes be an issue for them is moving it fluidly between midfield and attack. And I think Dele Alli could possibly contribute with something there in terms of moving the ball forward, be it running with the ball or playing incisive forward passes. You know, if Verratti is suspended or breaks down, and he's often one of the two, there's not a lot of guys in that midfield who are moving the ball forwards reliably and effectively. Now, I wonder sometimes Dele Alli, I always thought he played some of his best football at Tottenham almost like a second striker, you know, making runs into the box and being a goal threat. But he is someone who, at his best, can move the ball very well as well. So you do see how he could potentially fit in. And it would be very interesting.
Let's move on to the Bundesliga, because every football fan loves a two-horse or a three-horse or a four-horse title race. Well, not everyone, but certainly the neutral observers, perhaps. And, of course, when the one team runs away with the league, we lose a certain amount of interest. And that has been the problem for the Bundesliga for many a season. We were hoping this season was different, Andy, but it looks like business as usual now.
Yeah, and I don't think this past weekend it was so much about the inevitability of Bayern going to Schalke and winning 4-0, although that obviously was a lasting impression of the weekend. The score flattered them a little bit, and those late goals by Müller and Alaba like made the score a little bit harsher than it maybe should have been, because Schalke gave a good account of themselves on the whole, I thought, caused Bayern a few problems, and that's something that maybe they couldn't have done a few weeks ago pre-Christian Gross. But it was the fact that at the same time, Leipzig, Leverkusen and Dortmund all lost at the weekend. They're the three most likely challengers. Now, of course, Leverkusen always lose at home to Wolfsburg. We know that. Leipzig's defeat at Mainz, who've had a terrible season so far and a lot of chaos off the pitch, that was a real surprise. And Julian Nagelsmann was absolutely infuriated that they conceded a couple of goals from set pieces. But Dortmund took the biscuit, because even though they played some good football away at Borussia Mönchengladbach in the Friday night game, and particularly between Erling Haaland and Jadon Sancho, they shot themselves in the foot, and especially in the second half, defended quite badly. They conceded three goals from set pieces, which was one up from what Leipzig did the following day. And it's just that sense of Bayern have had their difficulties, particularly at the back this season. But the other teams have let themselves down in really sort of perplexing circumstances often, in the scenarios that you'd least expect. I mean, I know we think of Borussia Mönchengladbach and Dortmund as a huge game. Dortmund have won the last 12 competitive games between these two teams. And so that Dortmund managed to not just to lose, because that can happen, I think, against another good team in the Bundesliga, but really the manner in which they did it, that they shot themselves in the foot. There's a sense that we're almost having a bit of a rewind to the days of Carlo Ancelotti and Niko Kovac in charge of Bayern, where Bayern, even when they're at their strongest, maybe neutrals, Lars, feel that they're given a bit of an easy ride.
It's frustrating, because Bayern, you can get at them this season. And the huge sort of thing when Hansi Flick came in, the thing that made them this sort of all-conquering, you know, the best football team in the world, let's be honest, last year, was that they restored the high press. You know, they started pressing again after Niko Kovac felt they couldn't do it. And it turned out they could. you just had to tell them to, and also play Thomas Müller. But they're not just, you know, a team of superstars. They're the team that pressed the most aggressively in the league, and they don't let you settle. But as we know, and as we've seen in several leagues, it's hard to play that way this season because it's so many games. You don't have the usual number of rest days between matches. You don't have the big winter break as you usually have. So just, and it's very draining on the team's energy to play, I think, the way Bayern would ideally like to play. So it's looked a little bit looser this season. Now, they kept a clean sheet against Schalke and at Augsburg. Before that, they had a run of like 10, 11 games or something in the league going all the way back to October where they didn't keep a single clean sheet. So they don't strangle opponents in quite the same way that we're used to seeing them do. They can be got at. And I think there are even personnel issues defensively with Niklas Süle, who, you know, has his detractors, and David Alaba, who's on his way. And, you know, they look more vulnerable than we're used to seeing them. And there was this fear when everything fell into place last season under Hansi Flick that, oh my God, they're just going to be amazing forever now. But they haven't been this season at all. And what I thought was interesting about this weekend was that there were two challengers who failed in very predictable ways, and one that failed in a completely new and spectacular way. by which I mean, the Dortmund defeat was so typical of Dortmund in the sort of late Lucien Favre era and lately Dortmund, in that you have two really good goals, great work from Jadon Sancho, good finishes from my boy Erling Haaland, but they're just so, like, defensively not very good. And it's so typical for this Dortmund team that you have incredible talent and incredible youth who are so exciting going forward, but you just can't rely on them. And guys like Hummels, Emre Can, and the guys who should be the mature leaders, Buchi as well is a big character, but someone who has mistaken them. They're just not reliable, and they're not the young stars are not getting the support that they need from the more established figures there. Whereas Leverkusen, like you say, of course they always lose to Wolfsburg, and I think that makes perfect sense, especially under Oliver Glasner. You know, in the land of the blind, you know, the one-eyed man is king. Well, I'd put it to you that in the land of the Bundesliga, a team that can actually defend will usually do quite well. Because, you know, I do love the Bundesliga, but you do watch the games there, and there's a lot of times you go, hang on, where's the fullback gone? Like, where's the centre half over there? Like, there's a lot of loopy defending going on in this league, whereas Wolfsburg actually keep their shape really well and seem like they know where to stand, and the distances are very good. So they're not a spectacular team, they don't have a lot of stars, but they're fourth in the league with the same number of points as Leverkusen, which is impressive. Now, they're the opposite of Leverkusen, you know, Peter Bosch's freewheeling Leverkusen, you know, this sort of rigorous positional stuff, that's a very bad opponent for them. But what I'm getting at is that my biggest disappointment, like, you kind of expect Leverkusen to come unstuck in this sort of game. You're not surprised, sadly, at this point to see Dortmund have that kind of a misfortune. But Leipzig just being bad against Mainz, that was weird. Like, I did not see that coming at all, Andy. Julian Nagelsmann rightly angry. This is not a game they can lose for a team in their position. What's happening?
No, you're right. And I think you look at teams struggling to produce the same intensity again and again. As a really good example of that, I thought they were pretty flat. And Nagelsmann had a sense of this does not compute afterwards either. The fact that they let Moussa Niakate sort of swan in and score two goals from set pieces when he never scores, to the extent where he employed a swift handshake to celebrate his first goal with a series of teammates. The fact that Mainz were a little bit smarter. The fact that Nagelsmann's changes didn't really impact on the game at any stage. I think there are a few issues here. Firstly, Leipzig, I don't know, I've never really felt that they're quite ready to challenge yet. And you look at the second half they played against Dortmund, and that was a case in point where Dortmund were far better than them a couple of weeks ago. Of course, for Dortmund fans, this might have been the moment where they thought, oh, this is all going to click, because I think that there are layers of problems there, and it's, you know, it's not just all about the experienced players. I think at the back they're simply just short of numbers. They're a centre half short of the start of the season, and they are again now, because Manuel Akanji, I don't think he's ever going to develop into the centre back they want, and I think he's really the weak link in the defence. Thomas Meunier has not adapted very well, and you think, you know, Terzic even chose to pick Matteo Amori ahead of him last weekend, although Meunier is carrying an injury at the moment. He's been very, very disappointing. They're paying him enormous wages. But I think you look at the second half of that, and you talked about Lucien Favre there and the errors of his time. I think what's most difficult for Terzic, and you know, it's the last week where they lost to Leverkusen and to Mönchengladbach, two immediate competitors, was pretty much written off the chance of Terzic getting the job full time. But I feel a little bit sorry for him, because of course he's got very different ideas to Lucien Favre. But the team that was playing particularly second half, with so little pressure on the ball, so little pressure on the Gladbach players, how are they able to change from what Favre has been getting them to do for the last 2.5 years in, what, a week? Is that how long, really, without a game that Terzic has had to work with them? He's got no real time. I mean, I think it's complicated for someone like him to take over mid-season anyway and to instill a different sort of regimen into the team. But like, especially with the truncated winter break that you had in Germany this season, I think it's virtually impossible.
It's one thing for one of four title contenders to lose a match. You know, like you say, is it Leverkusen that always lose against Wolfsburg? Okay, fair enough. It's another thing for two title contenders, but then when you get three in a row and it becomes something of a pattern, looking at it from the outside, you wonder if this isn't a case of the chasing pack, because it will always be Bayern Munich that you're chasing at some point or another in the Bundesliga. Yeah. The chasing pack aren't bottling it. You know, that great book by Matthew Said called Bounce, about when sports people, and I'm not talking about the club itself, I'm not talking about the coach, I'm not talking about the tactics, but when the players themselves start bottling it and there's a little bit of sort of energy zapped from their legs when they face the opponents in an important game where they need to sort of keep in touch with the main contender, as it were, last year. Do you see where I'm going with that? Is there any sense of the other teams here bottling it at a crucial point?
I think you can make a strong case for that happening to Dortmund, not last season, but the season before, when they were in a great position and they lost some key games in the spring and they really didn't show up for them. And I think for that, but right now, I think there are just footballing reasons why these teams aren't that good. I think Andy's completely right about the defense of Dortmund is just not looking. Like I say, Akanji has been an ongoing disappointment, but also like Mats Hummels at this age. Are you super comfortable playing him in a back four? You know, maybe there's a reason Favre, as one of a three, where he's got two centre halves next to him helping him out. But, you know, Hummels offers you a lot, but he has certain limitations as well. Just footballing-wise, there's reasons why this Dortmund team isn't quite where it needs to be. Whereas I do wonder if a Peter Bosz team will ever be consistent enough to win a title here. Because they always have that sort of defeat in them. And Leipzig, I think Andy is spot on about maybe they're not quite ready and maybe they need to mature as a team in the sense that, and I think Dani Olmo has a big part to play there, of being a team that's not just all action and all running and can be a little bit more patient on the ball and take the sting out of things. I completely get what you're saying, and I think there have been years where the mentality issue has been there and been part of why the chasing pack are struggling with Bayern. But this year, I just think these are teams that are slightly dysfunctional in various ways. And yeah. I think it's especially frustrating for Dortmund because they're not going to have two sort of emerging global superstars like Jadon Sancho and Erling Haaland in their team that often. You know, for a team with their resources, there's a slightly higher tier of club in the world with slightly more money, maybe slightly more prestige, who's always going to come around and pick up those players if they happen to get them, Dortmund. And they have them together this year, which is exciting. And it's a shame that the supporting cast is not really there in terms of backing them up to the point where they can have a run at the title.
I just wonder if we're going back to the old thing again of waiting for a Bayern slip. I mean, Lars is right when he said they looked completely impregnable at the time they won the Champions League. And clearly, football as it is, Dortmund, and the world as it is has been or should have been a kind of leveler, really. The demands on Bayern, the same as everyone else, has been tough. But I wonder if the answer does come from within Bayern, because there's been quite a lot of chat this week of maybe Hansi Flick, despite him having a contract that goes for a few more years, not carrying on next season at Bayern, because he might take over from Jogi Löw as the Germany coach. Of course, he's had a huge role with Germany in the past, and because he's not had an entirely frictionless relationship with Hasan Salihamidžić, the sporting director, particularly over transfers. And, you know, that will come up again, A, with the exit of Alaba, and B, perhaps with the exit to come of Jerome Boateng, who's not got a new contract for next season yet. I think it does go back to the same old things. Like, can Bayern continue this Flick reign? And the other thing is, as Lars was saying, where Dortmund are next season, and I know we're leaping to next season already, I think to an extent we have to accept that and leap ahead to next season already. Are they able to hold on to, I don't think they'll hold on to both Haaland and Sancho, but can they hold on to one, who will probably be Erling Haaland? Mm. If they can, I think that's an enormous help to them. And of course, getting the right coach is going to be important as well, because it won't be Terzic.
Lars, will they hold on to Haaland? You're the person who's got him.
Yeah, I think my understanding is that he's happy where he is now, and there's no plans to move on as things stand. But I do think if they miss out on the Champions League, that's bad, and it becomes an issue of convincing him, as Andy's pointed out before, convincing him that they're moving in the right direction and they can build a team here that's right for him to be. But I think it's important to remember him and the people around him. They've always been very, very focused on his development. When they first moved abroad from Molde, from Norway, they went to RB Salzburg in Austria, in spite of having offers from bigger clubs and financially better offers, because they felt being in Austria with Salzburg was the best place for him to be in terms of his development and him progressing. And when they moved to Dortmund, I'm sure financially the offer was very good, but I'm also quite certain they could have gotten more money somewhere else at that time. It isn't always about the money with him, because the money will come, and there'll be no shortage of money for him and his family in the future. So they're really, really focused on him being in the right environment to develop as a player and to be successful. And that is Dortmund for now, and I suspect it probably will be Dortmund for next season as well. But if they miss out on the Champions League, which financially would be really bad for the club, especially since getting transfer fees for their players is harder now in this market than... If that impacts their ability to put together a competitive team, it becomes a challenge in terms of convincing him to stay. But I think for now, that's what's likely to happen.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig.
Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This week at Sukarnov.
On Wrestle Me This Week, we talked about the worst way to accept a Hall of Fame award.
They were just telling you suck it.
You suck, and then he pours milk over
his head. Milk over
what
his head.
Is this?
Pouring milk over yourself is absolutely something that if you did it once in any scenario, people would never forget it. We were just having Christmas dinner and he just poured 2 litres of milk over himself.
Or if you're more in the mood for some awkward anecdotes, Alex shared his experience with the cast of Event Horizon on this week's Clash of the Titles.
We meet Smitty, played by Sean Pertwee, a man who I bumped into in a bar having never interviewed and literally chewed his ear off, trapped him in a corner of a booth where he couldn't actually stand up and get away from me and talk to him incessantly about this film. Later on in the night, his wife said to me, "Sean's outside if you want to carry on talking to him about Event Horizon."
All that and more. At Sukarnov.
So let's turn now to the home of the Marseillaise, if you like, one of the most beautiful cities in France, if not the second most beautiful. I'll leave that up to you, but can we start off with a quiz? Lars first. Who was it that said being in the stadium of Olympique Marseille and hearing the crowd roar was like being at a rave when the bass hits you in the chest? You know, when it really hits you in the chest and you feel it? Who was it that said that?
That sounds like an Andy Brassel-ism to me.
Your starter for 10. Andy Brassel, who was it that said that?
Yeah, it was me. The thing is, at the start of the phrase, I was thinking, I'm going to go for Gerard Depardieu when he was recording the series Marseille. But then when you got to the rave bit, I thought, no, that's not Depardieu's bag.
I was just thinking, Andy is the one that springs to mind who's comfortable both at the Velodrome and at a rave.
Well done and well sussed out. But we're experiencing, obviously, Marseille without that crowd thumping away and leading a chorus of support.
Yeah, we're moving on. Is to ABB, why? Increasingly not comfortable either at the Velodrome or at a rave.
Well, yes. So is that why everything seems to be crumbling around him there?
I think the absence of... it's hard to quantify this, but I think it's very, very... a very plausible theory to say that Marseille are one of the clubs that certainly suffer with the absence of fans and the absence of the spectacle around the games. And I'll give you one example. I think Dimitri Payet has a different season if there are fans in the stadium. I think he's a showman, you know. He likes to play to the crowd. And he's not had his best season, to put it very, very mildly. And he's... increasingly, there are reports that this town isn't big enough for both him and Thauvin. And that's, you know, metaphorically, but maybe also physically, looking at Dimitri Payet at the moment. He's a little bit bigger than he ideally should be. So I think he is someone who maybe thrives off of that energy. And I think when Marseille go about their business, when they sign players, they do keep it in mind that they know what they are, they know what the club is, and they know what playing for Marseille means. And it means, you know, being comfortable and capable and of enjoying that sort of carnival atmosphere. And you're bringing someone like Dario Benedetto up front from Boca, who's familiar with a bit of a lively atmosphere to lead the line up front. And you'll notice there aren't that many young players in this team compared to other clubs in France who tend to skew younger with their recruitment and looking to make money from selling them on. At Marseille, there's more of a case that you need to be more experienced and a bit tougher because you got to deal with what comes with playing for Marseille. And this season, what comes with playing for Marseille has been, you know, slightly different things than what it usually does. So I think for sure you're onto something there, Dalton.
It's funny, isn't it, how you know, some players just completely crumble anyway at Marseille and under the pressure. I think it's interesting that some of the more adept ones at dealing with it are the players, like, you could compare it a bit like Julian Draxler at Schalke, really. You're in this unique atmosphere, and if you've grown up with it, you get it a little bit more. And I think if you look at some of the players that have shone for Marseille in recent years, of course, Payet, he would say, is his town anyway. Mm. It's his city. But Boubacar Camara is someone who's been absolutely vital to them. It was one of AVB's early gambles to move him from defence into midfield. And as a holder, he was absolutely vital to them last season and then finishing second. But I do wonder, moving away from the players a bit, and we'll come back to the Tovan Payet argument in a minute, because it's key, but also because it's quite amusing. I think the Villas-Boas thing is interesting, because I think, crowd or no crowd, atmosphere or no atmosphere, vibe of the city or not, Villas-Boas was always going to find something to implode over. Because he's someone who is sporadically an excellent coach, and he has proved that at other clubs before. But he's also someone who is quite a restless character, who's quite an impatient character, who's quite an impetuous character. And I feel this all feeds into what's happening at Marseille at the moment. I mean, you know, they're on a run of three successive defeats at the moment. He actually offered his resignation after the first of those at home to Nîmes. And, you know, the combustible fans, of course, who can't make their presence felt and their feelings felt in the stadium at the moment. And I think this has quite an influence, the fact that fans are out of the stadium in all different places, on the tone of their expression about their teams. Because you can't make the way you feel apparent in the stadium, you have to make it apparent online and through fan club statements. And you had a couple of the fan groups coming out and telling the players they're a disgrace after losing to Nîmes. That's before they went on and lost at home to Lens and then lost at Monaco last weekend. But I kind of think Villas-Boas himself planted the seeds for this discontent autumn, really, because of the way that it went so badly in the Champions League. That hurt his pride very badly, I think. You know, people were talking about it being the continuation of Marseille's previous bad form in the Champions League, which of course they hadn't been in for 6 or 7 years, and they were going on this record run of defeats in the Champions League. And he quite rightly said, Villas-Boas, well, the start of that's nothing to do with me, and it's nothing to do with those current players, apart from Dimitri Payet, who was there the first time. But I think the way that he reacted to that, and he said, you know, there was that famous quote, wasn't he, that everyone found very amusing about, well, you know, to be shit in the Champions League, you have to get there first. We got there, and now we're being shit there.
Yeah.
If you're the players hearing that, and, you know, you've got your coach saying, well, we're just not of, we're not of the sufficient level, I think you've got to be able, as a coach, to contain your frustration a little better than that.
So when he tendered his resignation, what was the response?
No, carry on.
That's unusual, Lush, isn't it? I mean, most boards nowadays say, yeah, you want to go? Let's go.
But you got to bear in mind, though, the dynamics here, which is that he kind of wanted to leave after last season and had to be persuaded to come back, in part by the players, apparently, who asked him to stay. Them qualifying, I think this is something that's worth bearing in mind a bit when we're talking about how this is a big club culturally in terms of their meaning in a big football city where a lot of people care about football and a lot of people care about what they do. When they finish second in the league, I wonder if the temptation is to think, oh, well, we're back now. We're good. We're fine. We're going to be good. Marseille are going to be good. And you're kind of forgetting the fact that they did overperform quite dramatically to finish second. I think if you look at the underlying numbers, they were not the second best team in France last year. If you look at how many, you know, chances generated and expected goals and all of this, they were quite jammy finishing second. And when Villas-Boas then loses, Andoni Zubizarreta, the sporting director, who, you know, was there, was his ally there, he leaves the club and he thinks, we've already done slightly better than expected, and I've lost a key ally at the club. This might be a time, not a bad time to move on. But then he becomes persuaded to stay, wants to try to play in the Champions League with this team. That doesn't work out at all. His form then collapses in the league. You can see why he might feel, it's not a lot for me to stay here, really. Maybe I should just go.
And it's interesting how Pablo Longoria, the sporting director, who's quite a junior guy to be a sporting director, he starts the job and he's a little bit in awe of AVB. You know, he loves him. He wants to please him. But now he's far more on the page of, right, I want to do what's right for the club. And he's making his own moves. And he's only going to be emboldened by the fact that he's signed Arkadiusz Milik, which was a complicated deal. But they've been looking for what they call... locally, the le grand attaquant.
I've heard this. The grand attaquant.
The great striker is one word in Marseille. And they've been looking for it for a long time, and now they've finally got a guy who's got respect in European circles who wants to come and be their centre forward, which is a big deal. But if you're Milik and you've arrived into this situation, and you know Marseille is such a combustible atmosphere. But you can kind of understand it. You must be thinking, if you're Milik, what have I walked into? Because we talked about this row that's been reported between Tovan and Dimitri Payet. Now, Payet sort of signed this extended contract with the club last season when he was the one who was most resistant to wage cuts post-pandemic. He signed this extended contract and it's, right, well, I'm going to take less money, but over a greater period of time. So he's taking 50% less salary going forward. But he's contracted for longer. And part of the deal is a reconversion to a job on the board at the club when he retires. And apparently Tovan's main complaint is, well, you did that behind your back. You made it look as if you're Marseille for life and, you know, the ultimate servant to the club, where basically you've just feathered your own nest. Now, to be called out by that, like that, by the other star of the team, I reckon stings a bit. And also, a guy in Tovan, who's given a lot to Marseille, but is also out of contract at the end of the season and is going to walk for nothing and has refused all efforts from the club to move him and get a bit of money for him while they still can.
How's Marseille going to turn things around? How's AVB going to turn things around? I think he's got, or at least the board have got themselves into a situation now, because once the coach is more or is indispensable from the board's point of view, he's got powerful, he's sitting in a powerful position. But then I don't know how that translates into how we salvage this team where the walls are crumbling around them.
Well, I think you have when you have a manager who's like, I, you can sack me, that's fine, I don't care. That's not really a good start in terms of turning around a bad run of form. And you do wonder if, you know, the players who felt very, very strongly about him staying, if they would feel equally strongly about him staying now. I'm not sure about that. And it doesn't seem like a very, very good situation. But they have brought in Milik, and I think for a team that... you know, that hasn't scored a ton of goals this season, bringing in a new striker is exciting, you know, so maybe he can have a sort of galvanizing effect on it. And I mean, he, like you say, Andy, he is a good coach, Villas-Boas, and Marseille are like a notoriously difficult team to be in charge of. It's not like you can go out and get whoever you want to come there, and whoever you might get might not get the club and be able to get the players to pull together and all this sort of stuff. So, you know, I would be a little bit surprised if they sort of suddenly went on a barnstorming run and cruised into a Champions League spot in the second half of the season. But weirder things have happened, I suppose.
Andy, most important question of this conversation to you. So when all the pandemic restrictions are over, where would you rather be, at a rave or at the Velodrome?
Who's to say I can't be at a rave at the Velodrome?
Boom!
Is the right answer. Finally, let's talk about, well, not finally, because we'll come on to your games of the week as well. Looking forward to those, one from each of you. But before that, the January transfer window is coming to an end. Not a lot of business has been done, at least not a lot of high-profile business has been done. But there is one move that brings to an end a fairy tale, Andy.
It's kind of heartbreaking but exciting at the same time. Ever since we've known that Papu Gomez has been leaving Atalanta, it's been really hard to visualise where he would go, because it just seems such a perfect union between player and club. He was a huge part of them becoming established in the big four in Italy, and they are that now. And you know, you saw them go and win at Milan last weekend, and they played brilliantly. And I just felt in that game, which of course didn't involve Papu Gomez, this is a sense of how far Atalanta had come. That I didn't feel that Milan were absolutely awful. I just felt that they caught Atalanta on one of those days when they can take any team apart, and you feel that they can do that to good teams nowadays. And you know, of course, a lot of that goes a lot of the credit to that goes for Giampiero Gasperini. And him, in the start of winter, falling out with Papu Gomez, then that escalating to a dispute between Gomez and the president. I think neutrals felt that they'd lucked out when he didn't want to go to the Middle East when he was offered a move there last summer. But it turned out he wasn't much longer for Atalanta. But of all the moves that he could have got, I feel that him going to Sevilla is super, super exciting. Not just because they're maybe missing a player like that, because I think a lot of teams are missing a player like that. But you did think, when he was put on the market, his wages, his age being 32 for an attacking player, these were all things that maybe counted against him and maybe sort of tightened the field. But if you're going to get a team who are going to find a way to do a deal that looks tricky, maybe Sevilla and maybe Monchi are that team, Lars?
Yeah, for sure. But I like how this is... well, I'm very hesitant to ever say, oh, it's a great signing. Well, we don't really know yet, but it's an exciting signing. And I like how it shows you can... If you're Sevilla and you're that sort of bracket of club, sort of slightly behind the very top ones, what you're very often doing is signing potential. And this is what Monchi is so good at, is finding someone who plays in Ligue 2, or, you know, someone's an unpolished gem that Sevilla can get good service out of for 2 or 3 years and then sell to the Premier League for a ton of money. You know, this seems to be what generally happens, and this is the kind of thing that makes us, you know, praise Monchi for being a genius. But actually, the sort of good squad building can sometimes be about seeing, here's a 32-year-old who still has a lot of really good football in his legs and who we can bring in for a fee and for wages. But you know what? At the end of the day, the race for top four spots is going to be pretty tight in the league of the season, from the way it looks, with Villarreal looking very decent, with Real Sociedad being there and thereabouts. So having someone like Papu Gomez in the team can be the difference between fourth and fifth. And if you do that, then that move is paid for itself and then some.
Yeah, I do wonder if this had happened maybe a month ago, maybe we'd be talking about the title picture a little bit differently. Because we've been saying all season, or certainly at the start of the season, how what would stop Sevilla making a proper run at La Liga when in a season where Real Madrid and Barcelona are in a state of flux. We didn't really know what we're going to get from Atletico at the beginning. The feeling that they were really missing a centre forward. Now, over the last month and a half, Youssef and Nesri has started banging them in left, right and centre to the extent that West Ham have thought, he's had a good month, let's try and buy him. But he is the joint top scorer in La Liga at the moment. I think we have to respect that. Whether a good run of form becomes a consistently excellent player is a different question. But in terms of that, not just creative fulcrum, but in terms of that leadership on the pitch, you know, maybe that's something, someone to map the game out. Maybe that's what they've missed as well. I mean, we know defensively they're excellent. Bono has become the first choice goalkeeper off the back of some brilliant performances at the end of last season, especially in the Europa League. But I wondered, you know, you had this video to welcome him to Sevilla, talking about him being the latest in a string of great Argentinians to have played at Sevilla, and you've got all the ones from the past, obviously led by Eva Banega, and it was set, I think, to the sort of choral music you normally have in a horror film when a church is burning down, you know, something to give it that sort of gravitas. And then you see Banega, and you see Papu afterwards, and you think, okay, now we're talking. Because the fact that Banega went at the end of last season and did it in brilliant style and typical style by winning the Europa League, you think they have kind of missed that player. Now, the Ivan Rakitic signing was, I think, a self-conscious effort to plug that gap, not just in terms of his qualities, but in terms of his status at the club, having been fantastic for them before, marrying a local woman, being part of the culture, all that sort of stuff, and the fact that he said he was going to take the number 10 shirt in tribute to his old mate, the late great Jose Antonio Reyes. But Rakitic has really struggled this season. He's not been great at all. Actually, when they beat Valencia in the Copa del Rey this week, Rakitic scored the third goal. It's a fantastic chip. And the headline in Estadio Deportivo, which is the sports paper of Seville, said Papu Gomez gives Rakitic new batteries, with the idea being that the arrival of Papu Gomez, and yes, I think they can play in the same team together, and we know they can because Rakitic can take up so many different positions, and that's part of the reasons why he's been such a valuable player for Sevilla and Barcelona over the years. But the idea that Papu arriving is saying to Rakitic, look, if you want to lead the team, you're really going to have to lead the team. And Rakitic didn't only score this fantastic goal, and he kind of attributed the chip to Silva, the goalkeeping coach, who provides them with reports of all the goalkeepers they're going to face. And he was like, well, this guy's going to be off the line a bit, so maybe you want to have a go. But his all-round game, Rakitic, was absolutely fantastic, and it did feel that this is a moment maybe where he had to focus a little bit more.
I have got a fairy tale ending question for you in just a moment, Andy, but I don't know, Lars, if you want to come back on what Andy said. You wanted to add something in?
Yeah, just to say that I think you mentioned Rakitic, of course, and he used to be a more typical number 10, but he's been such he's had to adapt to Barcelona and become almost like a water carrier for them, or to find his place in that team. And I think him coming into Sevilla, yeah, he's taking the number 10 shirt, but he's not contributing as much going forward as Banega was. Banega was actually sort of very, very good at not just pulling the strings in midfield, but also popping up around the area. And I think adding someone like Papu Gomez, who gives them a little bit more incision up front, I think is makes a lot of sense. Papu Gomez is so much fun because he's you can tell, so his tactical development, you can really see it when he plays. You know, he played as sort of a second striker when he was very young back in Argentina. But Diego Simeone told him, listen, you're going to go to Europe at some point, and because you're so small, they're going to stick you out wide. So I'm going to play you out wide. And he initially didn't like it at all, because he doesn't want to run that much and he doesn't want to defend, and he didn't like it. But he did get used to it. And in the end, when he ended up going to Europe, he was also then coached by Diego Simeone in Europe. So he was played out wide. But you can definitely tell that he plays as someone who has the spatial awareness and the intelligence of someone who is probably a natural number 10 in terms of what he does, but who's played a lot of out wide in his career. So he's very happy to drift into wide areas and look for spaces there. And he gave this great interviews with El País not too long ago, the Spanish newspaper, where he said one of the things he does to find space on the field is to look at where the ref is. because the referee always positions himself to have the best view and to see everything that's going on. And so he's actually made it a point of principle that in a lot of games he'll sort of hang around in the areas where the referee takes up, because the referee is always in very clever positions, which I think is extraordinary. I've never seen anyone. It's really clever when you think about it.
He's giving it away now. Everybody will be doing it soon. But Andy, why did the fairy tale end for Gomez in Atalanta?
Because of the fallout with Gasperini, really. And it just wasn't solvable.
What was that about, though?
It was about him not following tactical instructions. So Julen Lopetegui, who's rehabilitated himself as a coach, is going to get someone who's a senior professional with a strong mind, which is going to be another thing for him to have to deal with. I feel pretty confident that Papu Gomez will be a success at Sevilla, but I think for Lopetegui to regard it with a little bit of caution and circumspection is probably no bad thing. Although Papu has said now he's left Atalanta, he always said when he left Atalanta he would come out and tell the truth of what really had been happened. So, you know, maybe we should expect the first book by the end of the season.
There's no truth in fairy tales, mate. It's all fantasy. Remember that.
Yeah, well, I do think Gasperini has expanded a little bit. Because Papu Gomez at Atlanta almost had his own role that doesn't really exist. What they call him, Andy? A tuttocampista. Someone who plays everywhere, basically. Mm. And it was almost as if the team would adapt to where he is. Like, he was allowed to go looking for the ball. He was allowed to drop deep if he felt that's what he wanted to do. He was allowed to, I guess, follow the referee around if that's what he wants to do. Like, I mean, he had freedom of the pitch most games. But, of course, this season, we saw it last autumn. And then, yeah, the year before, the first time they were in the Champions League, that Atalanta was struggling with the extra workload of playing both Champions League group stage games and also playing in Serie A. They really struggled in that period. We saw that a bit this autumn. And they're definitely one of the teams that have had to adapt the way they play because of the pandemic and because of the extra workload. And one of the things, I think Gasperini has suggested that actually now, it's hard for the team to compensate in the way they previously were able to for the fact that you have Papu Gomez kind of running around doing his own thing. And that's part of his thinking and wanting slightly different stuff, which I suppose makes sense. But it is, as you say, it is an interesting challenge for Lopetegui now, who's always been revered as a very good coach and someone who works really well with players. And we'll see how that goes.
So is that time for you both to recommend a unmissable game for us to watch this weekend? Andy, do you want to start by doing the honours?
I'm going to go Friday night. I feel like I've had a few Friday nights recently, but I think this is fair enough. I'm going to go for Lyon versus Bordeaux, the Battle of the Bourgeois in France. And
You might want to explain that. Battle of the Bourgeois?
Yeah, because these are the two most commonly recognised as the two most bourgeois cities in France. There's a degree of friction between the two over which is the most refined. But really, it's following on the interest of this game from Lyon trying to stay in the title hunt. They won 5-0 at Saint-Étienne last weekend against a very diminished Saint-Étienne who had a lot of players out with coronavirus, but that didn't stop Lyon celebrating wildly. But the reason I've gone after this is because it's the latest return of Atem Ben Arfa to Lyon. And of course, he nearly re-signed for Lyon twice, once in 2016 and then again in 2018. I do wonder how different is the back end of his career would have been if he'd have re-signed for Lyon in 2016 rather than going to Paris Saint-Germain, as he eventually did. He thought he was going to sign for Sevilla, but 10 minutes before, he got the call to see if he wanted to go back to Paris and sign for his home city club. But of course, the reason that fell apart is because one of the reasons that fell apart is when they were negotiating Lyon with Ben Arfa, the president, Jean-Michel Aulas, was asked about it in a press conference and he lifted his phone to show a text message he had from Atem Ben Arfa. And at that point, they thought, no, we can't work with this guy. So even though Bordeaux have been quite ordinary this season, I wouldn't put it past Ben Arthur to produce something spectacular going back to Lyon.
Do you want to declare an interest?
Well, I do most weeks, so there's no real need for me to do it again, is there?
You've lived in Lyon. That's all I'm saying.
And I had a lovely weekend in Bordeaux.
What happens in Bordeaux over a weekend stays in Bordeaux. You know that. Lars,
if you can even remember it.
That was a Norwegian aside, by the way. We nearly lost it.
Norwegians abroad, you know. Well, there's only one place for me to go, and that is to Leipzig versus Bayern Leverkusen. Bayer Leverkusen, apologies. And I think we've spoken about them today, the sort of the also-rans in Germany, the disappointing also-rans. Here, two of them face off together. It should be a fun game. I'm interested in seeing if Leipzig can bounce back from that atrocity against Mainz, which they will want to forget in a hurry. Or not, I guess, if you want to learn lessons from it. But that was very, very poor. Against Leverkusen, these are two sides who both like to push high up the field. No one will be sitting back here. I expect both would be trying to play attacking football. It should be fun. It's also a tale of two strikers. And I very much appreciate your good grace, Andy, for never bringing it up so far this season. But the Viking king, Alexander Sørloth, has not been a success at RB Leipzig so far. There are two very tall blonde Norwegians in the Bundesliga, and one is very much doing better than the other. After moving to Leipzig from Trabzonspor, where he was very, very successful, Alexander Sørloth has only scored once in six starts and 10 off the bench for Leipzig. One goal in the league. He scored once in the Champions League, but yeah, just one league goal, and that has been... He's not the problem, but you do wonder how much closer RB Leipzig would be to Bayern Munich if they had a centre forward who scored a lot of goals, rather than one who I insist he is a good footballer, but it hasn't been happening for him. And it's interesting, I say all this because lining up front for Bayern Leverkusen will very likely be Patrick Schick, who was very good for Leipzig on loan last season. Leipzig couldn't agree a deal with Roma, so they ended up going for Sørloth instead. Schick went to Leverkusen, where he's been altogether more productive than Sørloth has been for Leipzig. So it's a sort of battle of the tall strikers, of which one, my compatriot, Alexander Sørloth, sadly hasn't been very good. But I do think there is a good player there. He's just currently hiding.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.